AFEO Now is presented by Northwest Financial Advisors, where our world revolves around you.
Hello, everyone. This is Jim Hughes with AFEO Now. We are a program of recorded interviews with former senior U.S. intelligence officers and those who write about them. Today, I have a very interesting guest. His name is Brian Mora. He is a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer and senior aerospace executive. Most important, he helped to lead the team of U.S. intelligence officers in Japan who uncovered the truth behind the Soviet Union's shootdown of Korean Airlines Flight 007 in September of 1983. He also served on the air staff in the Pentagon before he left active duty. He has a BA from William & Mary. He has an MPA from Oklahoma and a master's degree in national security affairs from Georgetown. Brian, welcome to AFEO Now.
Well, thank you very, very much, Jim. It's great to be with you. Thanks for the opportunity.
Brian, why did you decide to fictionalize some aspects of this true story?
Well, one reason is I wanted to attempt at least to reach a broader audience than one might reach with a nonfiction treatment. And I think that the story of the 1983 Soviet nuclear war crisis is an important one for people to understand. And again, I thought a fictionalized but still heavy on the facts treatment would reach a broader audience of both people in our business and people who are not in the business, and make them more aware of the facts of the case and how it may be relevant to what's going on in the world today.
Brian, as we discussed off camera, I was kind of vaguely familiar with some of the details of the shootdown of KAL-007, but I had no idea how pivotal that was in the overall story. I think it would be useful, if you don't mind, to give our audience just a little bit more background on those events.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And one of the questions I often get, Jim, is why don't I know about this nuclear war crisis? And I think there are several important reasons for that. But one reason is that it wasn't a singular event like the Cuban Missile Crisis. And in fact, one has to connect dots to really see the fullness of the crisis and how it unfolded. And the first important dot to connect is the shootdown of a Korean Airlines 747 that occurred in the early morning hours of the 1st of September, 1983. And I view that, and many historians view it, as the trigger event for a series of events that unfolded over the next couple of months, culminating with the Able Archer 83 nuclear war exercise in Europe. So the Korean Airlines shootdown amplified tension between the Soviet Union and the United States. It nearly caused a shooting war because 2 days after the Korean Airlines shootdown, Soviet MiGs attempted to shoot down a U.S. Navy EP-3 intelligence collection aircraft and very nearly succeeded. So it really is a pivotal event that triggers a series of events as the fall unfolded in that in 1983.
How much of a role did, you know, less than optimal communications and also real fatigue on the part of both U.S. forces but also Soviet forces play in those events?
Another distinction, I think, between the 1983 crisis and the Cuban Missile Crisis is lack of communication between Washington and Moscow in 1983. And as our members will remember, in 1962, there were both formal and informal communications channels between the White House and the Kremlin during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Nothing like that really existed in 1983. There were strained relations, to put it mildly. The Korean Airlines shootdown kind of broke those strained relations apart, and the White House and the Kremlin were not communicating. And on the military side of the agenda or of the ledger, the military forces of the Soviet Union in the Far East were strained from months of high alert. The Soviet forces in general throughout the Soviet Union were under economic strain and other strains by that point in the Cold War. So I think lack of communication played a key role. I think the strain on forces, particularly the Soviet forces, played a role. And I also think from an intelligence standpoint that both sides were victims of mirror imaging of the other's intentions and motivations. I think that was a key problem in trying to sort through what was really going on and what was in the mind of the adversary. Each side was, I think, guilty of mirror imaging.
Who was GRU Colonel Ivan Levchenko, and what role did he play?
Yes, Levchenko is my literary creation, but he's a blend of the better traits of Soviet GRU and KGB officers that I knew in the 1980s. I wanted to make Levchenko a sympathetic character and not a stereotype. And blending these characteristics seemed to be the best way to do that. And Levchenko in The Able Archers is a full colonel in the Soviet GRU, Soviet Military Intelligence. He's an American specialist. He speaks fluent English as well as fluent German and Polish and Ukrainian and Russian. And he's a sophisticated individual, highly experienced. And I one of the reasons I made him that way was I wanted to contrast his vast experience with the relative inexperience of his American counterpart, who was a young Air Force intelligence officer modeled loosely or unloosely on myself.
Okay. Well, who was Air Force Captain Catani, and what role did he play?
In The Able Archers, Kevin Catani, again, is my alter ego to a large degree. And I put Kevin into some very highly stressed situations, including the night of the Korean Airlines shoot down, where he is happens to be the senior intelligence officer on duty at what is effectively was an Intel fusion center at U.S. Forces Japan headquarters. And so Catani is attempting that night to sift through ambiguous information, contradictory information, as will be familiar to all intelligence officers, to try to arrive at what the heck is really going on here. And then later in the book, I have him supporting the military liaison mission in Berlin, where he is tasked with meeting with Colonel Levchenko in Potsdam at the MLM's operational center in Potsdam, East Germany, to try to defuse the final crisis in this Soviet nuclear war crisis, which was precipitated by NATO's nuclear war exercise called Able Archer 83.
So let's fast forward to those events, primarily in Central Europe. What happened and what was the outcome?
Well, Able Archer 83 was the final phase of Autumn Forge 83, which was, many of us will remember, an annual NATO exercise that encompassed a number of interlocking exercises beginning in September of 83 through October and into November. And the exercise scenario is a conflict between NATO and the Soviet Union, and that a conflict that escalates from conventional through chemical warfare phase and then finally into a nuclear war phase, which was called Able Archer 83. What made Able Archer 83 a bit, well, unique, really, were several factors. One was the enormity of the tension between the Soviet Union and the United States that, again, it didn't start entirely with the Korean Airlines shootdown, but was really heightened and triggered by the Korean Airlines shootdown. Another factor was that Soviet leader Yuri Andropov, who was General Secretary of the Communist Party, many will remember that he had been chairman of the KGB for many years prior to taking the top job. And Andropov lived in mortal fear of a NATO nuclear first strike, a decapitating first strike that would take out the Kremlin and other Soviet leadership. And Able Archer 83, given the context of these heightened tensions, to many in the Kremlin looked like the real thing. It looked like, if, as we know, Soviet doctrine calls for attacking under the guise of an exercise, they mirror imaged and felt that, well, Able Archer 83 could be cover for an actual intention to launch a nuclear first strike. Many will also remember that late 1983 was when a new generation of American nuclear capability was being introduced into West Germany and into the United Kingdom. In West Germany, the Pershing II ballistic missiles, and in the UK, ground launch cruise missiles. And the Kremlin viewed both of those weapon systems as highly destabilizing, first strike, decapitating systems. The Pershing IIs, for example, once launched from West Germany, could reach the Kremlin in 6 or 7 minutes. So it was the totality of those contextual aspects, I think, that led the Kremlin to be extremely paranoid about what was going on in Europe and around the world, but especially in Europe during Able Archer 83, the culminating phase of that fall's series of exercises. And the Soviets reacted in unprecedented ways, and I think this is a key point, to Able Archer 83. The level of a nuclear alert that Soviet theater forces went to in East Germany and Poland, and that their intercontinental nuclear forces went to, both their all three legs of their triad, the ICBMs, the nuclear submarines, and their nuclear bombers, was, if not unprecedented, highly unusual in the history of the Cold War. So the Soviets were preparing for a nuclear war in a very serious way in November of 1983.
And as I recall, to make things even more complicated, Andropov suffered a serious health crisis and was actually in the hospital and had the Soviet nuclear codes with him.
Yes, Jim, that's our understanding. And that comes from Marshal Ogarkov, I believe, who was the head of the general staff at the time. The general staff was very concerned about Andropov's state of mind. He was in the hospital, as Jim, as you said, with terminal kidney disease. And again, they worried about his stability. Another couple of factors to point out that occurred in the fall of 1983 that were highly unusual, if not unprecedented. One is that the Soviet military, which their ground forces in particular, which normally took a heavy role in the Soviet harvest, in harvesting grain and the like, did not do so in the fall of 83. They were kept in their barracks. They were sent out on field exercises. And in addition to that, there were civil defense drills in Moscow, Leningrad, and other major cities that were extremely unusual. And there were speeches made by members of the Politburo warning the Soviet citizenry that nuclear war was imminent. So all of those things combined to create an atmosphere of extreme concern, if not paranoia, in the Soviet Union during, especially in October and November of 1983.
So what stratagem did the principals come up with to help de-escalate the tensions?
The principals didn't really come up with one, and that's one of the scary aspects, I think, of the 1983 crisis. And in fact, the principals in Washington weren't even really aware that this crisis was unfolding at the time. It only became apparent months later that, or even years later in some cases, that tensions had reached the boiling point. What we found in 1983, in all three major events of the crisis that fall, beginning with the Korean Airlines shootdown, is that local leaders, local commanders, local intelligence officers, they themselves dampened the flames, tamped down the flames. In the case of Able Archer 83, the senior Air Force intelligence officer in Europe, who was a brigadier general at the time, Leonard Perutz, he and his staff, and I was in a role where we were supporting him from Washington during Able Archer 83, they were alarmed, and General Perutz in particular was alarmed at these unprecedented Soviet nuclear alerts in Poland and East Germany. And he reported those to his leadership, including the NATO leadership. And he was asked, as a relatively junior guy, he was a one-star general, he was asked, what should we do? should we retaliate in kind? In other words, should we increase our nuclear alert posture in Europe in response to what we're seeing on the other side of the Iron Curtain? And Perutz, and he later said it was gut instinct on his part, but I knew General Perutz pretty well, and I think it was also his deep understanding of the Soviets. His advice was, no, we should not. I think responding in kind will only ratchet things up. Let's not do anything, and let's just let the exercise run its course and act as though there's nothing unusual. It's just a command post exercise, Able Archer, that is. And let's just let things sort of fizzle out, if you like. And that was his advice. And the NATO leadership took his advice, and it was the right call. And General Perutz said years later in a classified report that he did when he retired as director at Defense Intelligence Agency, that he was kind of shooting in the dark when he made those recommendations. And he was thankful that he had done what he did, but he complained that he was doing so without full awareness of the intelligence that was available back in Washington on what the Soviets were doing. So in any event, it was personal intervention, leadership on the part of some key individuals in the Korean Airlines shoot down, in the ICBM scare that happened in late September, where a Soviet officer elected not to advise a retaliatory strike to what turned out to be false alarms of ICBM launches from the United States. And then General Perutz, lastly, in Able Archer 83, where he urged caution and urged not to act in kind to Soviet preparations for nuclear war.
So what public demonstration did you all come up with to signal to the Soviets that Able Archer was only an exercise and there was no attack that was imminent?
Well, in the Able Archers in the novel, I came up with a device that was the brainchild of Colonel Levchenko for Ronald Reagan to, on the climactic day of the Able Archer exercise, to wear a white Stetson hat and for Prime Minister Thatcher to wear a white suit. That actually did not happen. That was an artistic device on my part. But what did happen was that in the original scenario for Able Archer, both President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher were to take part personally in the weapons release portion of the exercise, which had never happened before in history, that the president and prime minister actually participated in that phase of the exercise. That was called off. Their participation was called off. We're not sure if the Soviets knew that or not, that they were not going to participate. So we're, because the KGB and Ministry of Defense files of the Soviet Union around the 1983 crisis have never been released, we don't really know what they knew and when they knew it. So there wasn't really a public demonstration. I guess the closest thing to a public demonstration of peaceful intention was General Perutz's advice not to go to a higher nuclear alert posture.
And well after the fact, were President Reagan and Prime Minister Thatcher made aware of how close we came to a nuclear exchange?
Yes. And Prime Minister Thatcher was actually briefed by MI6 on a number of occasions during the Soviet nuclear war scare period about intelligence that that MI6 had from a KGB officer named Oleg Gordievsky. And Gordievsky was spying for MI6, and he was based at the Soviet embassy in London during 1983. And Thatcher met with Gordievsky once he defected successfully from the Soviet Union. And he personally explained to her what had occurred, from his point of view at least. And MI6 was, I think, of all the intelligence agencies, and partly because they had direct access to Gordievsky, they were really on top of what was going on in 1983, probably in a way that others weren't, including the U.S. intelligence community. As for Reagan, Reagan was apprised in the spring of, I believe it was actually June of 1984, in a report that Director of Central Intelligence Bill Casey took to him personally, and he was apprised of the danger that had occurred the prior fall. This has been and continues even today to be a somewhat controversial issue, especially within CIA. The initial CIA assessment in the winter of 1984 was that this was, while their tensions were very high and so on and so forth, they did not assess that the Soviets really thought we were going to execute a nuclear first strike, and therefore it was not as bad as some were saying. And I was still an Air Force intelligence officer at that time, and I know there was a lot of controversy between Air Force intelligence and CIA on those conclusions. Casey ultimately was convinced that CIA report, it was a special NIE that was done, I think it was published in April of 84. He came to the conclusion that special NIE downplayed the danger too much. And he instead kind of championed an alternate report, and that's the one that ultimately went to Reagan and the rest of the National Security Council, again in June of 1984. We know that Reagan, in statements he made and in his own diary, he confided to his diary that he was shocked to learn that the Soviets really believed that we might conduct a nuclear first strike. And I think there were a number of factors that led to Reagan's change of heart and mind in his second administration with respect to negotiating arms control treaties with the Soviet Union. But it seems clear that the 1983 nuclear war scare had an effect on him and his thinking, and that report from DCI Casey had a big impact on him.
Is there another book in the works? Is there going to be a sequel?
Yes, Jim, thanks for asking. I'm writing a series of books with the same two main characters, Kevin Catani, the American, and Ivan Levchenko, our Soviet GRU friend. And the next book, the second book in the series, is going to be published in April of 2024. And it's called The Righteous Arrows. And that book takes place it begins in the months right after the Abel Archer crisis seemingly concludes. And as we learned, it didn't conclude as conclusively as one might have hoped in the fall of 1983. So it begins in the spring of 1984, and it goes through 1986, and it includes action in the Soviet war in Afghanistan. And Ivan Levchenko becomes head of the GRU in Afghanistan, and Kevin Catani is with the CIA Special Activities Unit that is supporting Operation Cyclone, which was the operation to arm the Mujahideen that I'm sure many of our members are intimate with. So that's the second book. And then the subsequent books march these two characters through history, so to speak. And so they're all historical novels. They're all based on fact, but they put our two lead characters into situations associated with those historical events.
Well, the first book is entitled The Able Archers. It's a fascinating read, a fictionalized version of true events. I really enjoyed reading it, and I look forward to the second book. And I want to thank Brian Moore for a very interesting interview.
Jim, thank you very, very much. It's been a pleasure chatting with you this morning, and it's a great organization, and I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to talk to your members. Thank you very much.
AFIO is a small, nonprofit, apolitical, educational organization whose main mission is to help prepare the next generation of intelligence officers to confront the challenges our nation faces in the years ahead. To learn more or support our outreach programs, visit www.afio.com.